Hello and welcome to the first House of Commons podcast of 2013 with myself, Emma Burnell, who blogs for The Scarlet Standard, a Labour blog, and Mark Thompson, who blogs for Mark Reckons, a Lib Dem blogger. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
We are full of turkey and full of cheer and resolution, and we hope that you are too. Certainly it seems that politics has kicked off of 2013 with a bang. Labour are making a big new announcement on jobs guarantee. So, Mark, what are your initial thoughts on this?
Well, my initial thoughts are multifarious. Firstly, a Happy New Year, by the way, Emma.
Happy New Year to you too. Multifarious is your New Year's resolution to use words I don't understand.
I always use words that people then kind of say, why are you using that word? it's a particular quirk of mine. I'm pleased, first of all, that Labour are starting to put some flesh on the policy bones, because it's been, I found it very irritating in the last year or two that they constantly criticised the government and yet very rarely had any concrete policy announcements of their own. And I think it's actually quite a brave policy announcement to do 2.5 years out from the next general election. My understanding of what's being announced is that Labour are going to suggest that the top 2% of people who are saving for pensions should lose the tax relief. So I think it's for, if I understand this correctly, it's for higher rate taxpayers who get the relief at 40%, and instead they won't, they'll only get it at 20%. And therefore that money, which I think is going to be something like 1.5 or 1.7 billion, is going to be used to give jobs to people who are long-term unemployed for a few months, paid at minimum wage. Now,
it's at least minimum wage. I think that can then be up to the company if they decide to pay them more than that.
Right, okay. I mean, I think the fact that they're saying that there are certain people who should have tax relief removed from them, I think is right, and I completely agree with who they're targeting here. I mean, straight away I started to notice, you know, people and pensioners groups and so on complaining. But I mean, whenever you have any changes to the tax system that are going to adversely affect some people, you always get complaints, and people will always complain that it's unfair. But I really don't see how you can honestly say that, you know, making these tax relief changes to the top 2%. I mean, if you're not going to do have cuts affecting the top 2%, then who are you going to have them affecting? I mean, I don't buy that argument at all. So I think targeting at that demographic, I think, is right. However, I have some reservations about what they're planning to do with the money. I am concerned that you could just end up in a situation where what's happening is effectively taxpayers are subsidising Tesco to have people stacking their shelves that they'd otherwise have to pay for themselves.
Oh, Mark, you had to go there. I'm so sorry. Can I just once and for all just say to somebody, what the hell is wrong with stacking shelves? Why is it so awful? Why are those people who are currently stacking shelves for a living, working very hard and paying their taxes? And every time we talk about this, every time, oh, we're going to pay people to stack shelves. Yes, we're going to pay people to do a job. And that's a perfectly decent job. We need to stop denigrating it.
Okay, all right. And that was quite a good impression of me, actually. Or you made me sound posher than I actually am. I agree with you.
It's not just you. I mean, I get it from the left as well as the right. It's, you know, everybody, when they're talking about this kind of thing, and when they're talking about minimum wage jobs, always they go to the stacking shelves. And actually, you know who started off stacking shelves? Terry Leahy started off stacking shelves. There is a job with prospects. It is a job that you can go somewhere, you can build your way through the supermarket chain, end up running a supermarket, end up running in management. It is not a bad job.
Yeah, okay. But I think it's fair to say that most people who start off stacking shelves don't end up being in the position that Terry Leahy is in. I think it's used as a political shorthand, isn't it, for a kind of entry level job. I mean, that's what I meant. I meant entry level jobs for people. And I mean, I think the substantive point here is that, you know, are we going to have a situation where the taxpayers are effectively subsidising these jobs, and the companies that would otherwise have to use their own money and their own profits to pay for these people are getting them subsidised by the taxpayer, and then after 3 months, 6 months, whatever it is, there's no job for them, and then they just go back onto benefits, you know, onto out of work benefits. And but then the counters reset, so they're no longer considered long-term unemployed because they had a job in quotes for 6 months. And I'm putting the word job in quotes not because I don't think being a shelf stacker is a job, because I don't necessarily think that these are real jobs if there isn't an actual proper job at the end of it.
Okay, well, there are two responses other than my shelf stacking rants, because I'm just fed up with the snobbery around jobs that we have in this country. You can't be a shelf stacker for life. You can't be a barman for life. You are looked down upon. And this is across the political spectrum. I was at a Labour Party meeting the other day where someone said, oh, and you can't do a real job unless you do an internship first. I'm like, what? You can't do an academic job. Maybe you're a media job or a think tank job, but that's not a real job.
That's privileged bullshit, exactly. What that person just said. That, you know, the idea that internships are the only gateway and that you have to do one. You know, that's all very well if your mum and dad can afford to, you know, exactly, pay your rent for 6 months or 12 months or 18 months or whatever it is, you know, until you actually are able to earn some money and, you know, live in London. Anyway, sorry. I mean, I think I basically agree with you on that point. And I will go away and think about my shelf stacking reflex anyway. But on the substantive point.
On the substantive points, I think there are two things. One, well, first of all, I think this is a step up from what we have now, which is workfare, which is exactly this, but they're not paid. So I'm much happier with this than I would be with workfare, because I think people should be paid for the work that they do, whether it's a real job or not. It's a job that gets somebody into work for 6 months, gets them into the habit of work. It's often said, and every time you talk to a recruitment consultant, they'll tell you it's easier to get a job from a job.
Yeah.
So actually, a lot of these measures are not just about the job that they go into, but the skills that they acquire. Having been long-term unemployed myself, I was unemployed for a year, and then I got a job in a call centre. Yeah, it wasn't the world's greatest job, no, but it gave me self-respect, it gave me some money in my pocket, it gave me a routine, it gave me all the things I needed to start getting myself back on my feet and out of the bad habits that I'd got into when I didn't have anything to do with my days. So I think that there's more to it than just, I think it's a step up, a giant leap from workfare, which doesn't work. I mean, workfare has proved to be statistically less likely to get you a job at the end of it. So if we're going to do this, then we should do it in a way where people are at least paid. It should also, I think there are concerns on the left about the compulsory aspect of it, which I myself don't have. I think there is a confusion amongst those people who are arguing against this scheme. First of all, they say you're aligning yourself with those people who say that the unemployed are slackers, and then they're saying, well, you don't need to, you know, don't make it compulsory. And I think, well, if as I believe most people who are long-term unemployed want to work, then the compulsory element won't really matter that much. It'll hit a few people who are maybe less inclined to go back to work, which is a very small percentage. And actually, I think by giving both those narratives, the left have rather confused themselves and are themselves perpetuating the slacker stereotype. Secondly, I think that there are some tweaks that I would like to see, or actually some detail, because we actually haven't had all the detail on how it's going to work. And while you talk about Tesco's and shelf stacking, it's not the shelf stacking aspect that worries me at all. But I think it might be interesting if this was also used as a way of promoting small businesses and helping small business to recruit, and used alongside some other measures and incentives to get small business to recruit. And actually, maybe you put a cap on the size of enterprise that was involved in this scheme and made it something that was particularly useful to SMEs.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent idea. And that would go quite a long way to address some of my concerns about, you know, the larger companies perhaps taking advantage of this. My fear is that won't happen for probably a couple of reasons. Firstly, practical reasons, trying to get agreement from, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of SMEs is probably quite difficult. Getting agreement from Tesco, Sainsbury and a few other large companies is much easier. And also the CEOs of Tesco's and Sainsbury's, etc., you know, will are the sort of people who probably meet senior shadow cabinet members all the time at soirees. And again, you know, that's probably why it's going to be just easier to arrange, just because of the politically pragmatic reasons.
I think that may be true. It's certainly something that I will be writing about and asking the party to look at least. And, you know, I think that there is a quite strong sense within the party at the moment that SMEs may be where we could be at. You know, a lot more sort of in terms of the responsible capitalism agenda, I think there's a lot of talk about how SMEs can be the focus of that. So it might fit right into that narrative, in which case I may be pushing it an open door.
Yeah, well, I think there's a gap in the market, because I've been quite disappointed with this government's lack of focus on SMEs. I mean, particularly when you look at the changes that George Osborne has made to tax rates. You know, I think corporation tax when this government first came in was 28% for large companies. Mm-hmm. And then they reduced it progressively down to, I think, 24%. And I think it's going to be either 23 or 22% by next year. And in that time, when they've reduced it by about 6% for large companies, for SMEs, it's gone down by 1%. It was 22%. It's now 21%. I may have that wrong. It may be going down to 20%, but they still haven't reduced it anywhere like as much as for larger companies. And okay, it was from a lower base, but my fear is what they're actually trying to do, I think I might have said this on the podcast before, is trying to align those rates. Yeah. So they end up in lockstep with each other. Whereas actually, I think reducing rates for SMEs at the same way that they've reduced them for the large companies, I think would have been a great boost for the economy. You know, people are saying, and we may talk about this later, about needing growth in the economy, and that this government really doesn't seem to have a plan for growth. Well, reducing corporation tax for small companies is they're the engine of the economy. And, you know, if we're going to get a decent recovery, they are going to be centre of it. So, you know, I think Labour, if they can be seen as the friend of SMEs, then I think that would be a very good thing for them politically. And I certainly think that there's a very fertile ground that they could be sowing their seeds on if they decide to do that.
Yeah, we'll see. I think there's more to come throughout the year. I mean, Labour have been promising not necessarily funding commitments, because we are just too far away from the election to say here's how what we'll pay for and what we'll cut and what we won't. But ideas like this one on business and welfare and we've had some interesting stuff on transport today.
Yeah, am I right in understanding this announcement they've made? They actually haven't promised that they will definitely do it. They've said that this is what they would really like to do.
But yeah, I mean, like your party, we have a system. Things don't go in the manifesto until they've been through the policy process.
Yeah.
So they've made this announcement. They've said, here's something we think would be a good idea for the government to do now. It is almost certain that even if a lot of people didn't like it, and I don't get the impression that's the case, there'd be a reasonable amount of arm twisting, horse trading and negotiation through the policy forum process, through the clause 5 negotiations at the end of when the manifesto is being written. It'll need to go through conference and need to be voted on at conference. So we can't say this is our policy because it hasn't gone through our policy process. But it is something that we are saying, we think the government should take this idea and do it now. Mm. We don't have to pass it through their policy process. Mm. And we think that if they don't, we are likely to put this in our next manifesto and we will try to take it through the policy process.
Mm. Well, they're doing better than Nick Clegg and some Lib Dem ministers, because they just announced policy that's never seen the light of day in front of conference, like at Lib Dem conference when Nick Clegg started talking about, I can't even remember what it was now, there was something that he clearly, that you know, hadn't been discussed and hadn't been voted on, and he was talking about it as if it was policy. So, yeah.
Well, this is the joy of opposition, is you've got time to take it through your policy process.
Of course.
I suspect if we get back into government, when we get back into government, that will go away again. I'd like to think it won't, but you're finding out now that you don't have a policy process in government. Mm. It just doesn't happen.
We do, but it's not working properly. So, yeah. And just on the broader point on this, I mean, do you think that this is part of the next stage of Labour in opposition that they really are going to be coming out with concrete announcements? Or do you think this is kind of a, well, you mentioned a couple of other ones, but do you think this is maybe just a little New Year flurry and then it'll calm down again for 6 months or 12 months? Or do you think there's going to be kind of staged announcements over the course of this year?
I think there'll be staged announcements at certain times throughout the year. I don't think it's going to be like one a week or anything like that. But there'll be some big stuff prior to the budget, some big stuff just before the summer probably, some big stuff at conference, of which, of course, there was last year. So, yeah, at key political moments, Labour will come out with something so that the papers are talking about their ideas as well as talking about whatever the government are doing or doing wrong.
I mean, the big risk is that the government will just steal the policies if they're any good.
That's the thing. And, you know, if that happens, well, I mean, partly you just have to say, well, that's OK because it was a good idea and it will make the country better, which at the moment is desperately needed. And partly you have to say, OK, well, stop asking us what we'll do then.
Well, I remember in, I can't remember what year it was, 2008, where the Tories had announced at conference that they were going to make changes to inheritance tax.
It was 2007, because it was the year that the election, it's what finally killed the election that never happened.
Yeah, of course it was. And then not long after, the government, the then Labour government, made some announcements about inheritance tax that were suspiciously similar to what George Osborne had announced. And I always remember this because I just remember it was like a little freeze frame, a little snapshot of just what is wrong with politics. As that was announced, I think Alistair Darling made the announcement, and you could see Osborne and Cameron reacting, basically pointing at them, saying that was our idea. And Gordon Brown was just pointing at them, laughing. And I just looked at him and I just knew exactly what he was thinking. We've stolen your idea. What are you going to do about it? And it was like, pathetic. But, you know, that's the way politics works. And that's why, one of the reasons why I thought Ed Ball's announcing this is quite brave, because, you know, it could be stolen. And also, the government have got 2.5 years to give it a kicking and to say where you're going to get the money from and find holes in it and find problems with it. You know, a little bit like I was saying earlier on, I mean, I don't think this is bulletproof. I think there are problems with it. It gives the government something to attack.
It does, but I think this government would be really hard-pressed to attack on long-term unemployment. I think they'd, to say, don't introduce a measure for long-term unemployment that's funded by rich people.
No, I don't think they would do it like that. I think they'll say it won't work and they'll say that it's misguided. You know the way politics works.
Yeah, they
won't directly attack it, but they'll find ways to undermine it.
They're losing all credibility. So how do they attack? When they attacked Labour, things that Labour had done in government, they had things to attack them on. Attacking ideas from a government that's not working is a lot harder. And I know that because it was a hell of a time from Labour.
I'm sure Flashman will find a way at the dispatch box, though. You know what he's like.
Oh, I'm sure he'll give it his best shot. I just don't think it'll work the way it would have worked 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point.
So speaking of the lovely, charming Mr. Cameron and his sidekick, I believe they've got some announcements to make tomorrow. They're announcing the midterm review, or the Didn't We Do Well?
Yeah, well, I was on Sky News earlier on today. They asked me on to talk about this, and then, I don't know why they asked me on today, because it's not even being announced till tomorrow. We're recording this on Sunday. I'm not quite sure yet when we're going to release it. So by the time people are listening to this, it's probably already going to have been announced. But yeah, I mean, we've got some ideas about what's going to be in this review, and there's policy ideas for the rest of the parliament, things like road building, social care, measures to tackle youth unemployment, pensions and childcare. They're the things that I've picked up on anyway. But when I was on the telly earlier on, I did say that this sounds a little bit like marking your own homework, basically. You know, I mean, I really can't imagine that this is going to be a warts and all appraisal of how the government has done. Actually, what you need for that is to wait 5-10 years until the memoirs come out and then read what Cameron and Clegg and Osborne and the rest of them really thought at, you know, the start of the new year 2013. We're not going to find out at the moment, because, you know, the government is obviously not going to criticise itself. It's going to talk up what it's done, and it's going to try and claim that, you know, it's better than Labour. Because obviously that's... So I almost feel like this is a pointless exercise, really. But in terms of setting out their stall for what's going to happen in the rest of the parliament, I think it could be interesting. I think some of the stuff around childcare and social care could be quite interesting. My understanding is that they're going to announce a cap of £75,000 on social care, which doesn't go as far as Dilnot wanted. I think he wanted a cap of about 35 or 36,000, but at least it's a cap. It's a starting point.
It's a starting point, that a future government could bring down.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's better than nothing. And I mean, I don't think it's good that the cap is so high, because I do think it then does once again support the rich over the rest. But on the other hand, I don't want to let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And if they set out the basis of this, that does give the next government space to make it better.
Yeah, and I suspect that's what will happen. I think it will come in at a certain level, and once people see that it is workable and it is working, then there's scope to bring it down. So I don't necessarily have a problem with it being brought in at that level. And then the childcare stuff, I mean, I think that is going to become quite significant over the coming years, I think. Now, I think it's Liz Truss who has done a lot of work on this in opposition, and now I think she was appointed the minister for this precisely because of all the work that she's done on it. And I think they're going to deregulate the childcare industry and try and make things more affordable. Now, whether or not you think that's a good thing, I think it's a significant thing. I was actually talking to someone about this today, and I was saying that, I mean, it's always the way when new policies are introduced that have an element of risk to them, because let's face it, deregulating childcare has elements of risk attached to it. And it's not going to take that many stories about, you know, the problems with childcare and situations where, you know, children are neglected or abused or whatever, for the fingers to be pointed at the deregulation and for people to say, well, it's because of this deregulation. So again, I think this is probably a fairly brave thing, but it could, if they can make it work, it could make quite a significant difference to the economy, because I think there's about a million, mainly women out there, who aren't working because they can't afford childcare and otherwise would be able to be, you know, contributing to the economy and earning a living and all the rest of it. So it's, I think that could be a very important thing over the coming years.
I think it's astonishing how often they manage to pick on industries that not only don't mind being regulated, but actually welcome regulation and say, no, we're going to regulate you because it will work. I happen to have quite a lot of family background in childcare. My mother ran the National Child Minding Association for many years and then went on to run an umbrella group for children's charities. Childminders like regulation because it protects them as much as protecting the children for whom they care. When I was in housing, again, we liked having an ombudsman. It's important to us because it protects the housing association as much as it protects the tenants. And again, it's deregulation will always work because we think it will always work, rather than actually having a real reason for it. I agree that the cost of childcare in this country is insane. I don't agree that the way to make it better is to make it less secure and less safe for our children. I don't think poor people should have less secure childcare than rich people. I don't think that's the right way to go about it.
But is it necessarily going to be, you know, as stark as that? You know, I mean, I must admit, I'm not across this maybe as much as I should be. I'm not sure they've even announced enough detail for me to be able to be across this. So maybe we'll have to wait and see. But I mean, what other things could be done then in order to reduce the cost of childcare?
Well, it depends whether you're talking about reducing the cost of individual childcare to the family or the cost of childcare overall. The government can take on some of the cost of childcare, which would then be recouped with more people going to work and paying income tax. So you just have to look at it different ways round. You don't have to think the way to do this to make it cheaper in the private sector and then just leave it at that, rather than thinking about how government could intervene at different levels.
Okay, well, some statistics that I saw today suggested that the UK has the second highest childcare costs, as in the costs to individual families.
Yeah.
In the world. I think we're second only to Switzerland.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, what is it structurally about our economy that makes that so, and could...
Well, most of it's provided in the private sector. That's partly why it is. Childmind is a private sector, individually registered companies, as it were. Nursery care, which is what is so incredibly expensive, is largely private sector. So if you took a lot more of that into the state, subsidised it, paying for that subsidy by the fact that there is an increase in people working, increase in people paying their income tax, that is a different way of looking at it. Most places where the cost of the individual is considerably lower are places where these things are state subsidised.
I think one of the problems we'll have at the moment with this, and I suspect this is probably perceived as a long-term measure, is that if suddenly there were 500,000 or 1 million more people looking for work in this country because they could get childcare, they'd struggle to find the jobs anyway because the jobs aren't there. So I think we'd probably have to wait until unemployment's come down quite significantly before we'd see any real economic benefit from this. I'm not necessarily saying,
So you're saying the million or so women that you mentioned earlier aren't going to go back into the workplace?
I think it would be a struggle at the moment because there are so many people looking for jobs. I'm sure some of them would.
In which case, why are we deregulating childcare now?
Well, my understanding is that they want to do this just in order to make childcare more affordable so that people do have the choice to go back to work. What I'm saying is, at the moment, this is a bad... If suddenly they could click the fingers and it was all in place right now, I don't think now would be the right time to do it. But I suspect that it's going to be a process that's going to take quite a long time. And I guess the hope is that by the time it's implemented and it's working and, you know, people who are currently looking after the children who would prefer to have a job but can't afford childcare can, that the jobs are there. I'm just saying that at the moment, it's like quite a lot of these measures, I think it kind of has to be a long-term thing, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, but it doesn't have to be a long-term thing that's done in such a way that it threatens the safety of children.
Yeah, no, I don't get me wrong. I'm a bit wary about this as well. And I said right at the start, it's not going to take too many cases of... I mean, a bit like I think I had a conversation with you or someone about the NHS reforms when they were going through. And I think you said every single paperclip that goes missing will be blamed on these reforms.
Yeah.
And you're probably right about that, that, when things go wrong in the NHS, pretty soon the finger's going to be pointed at the changes, even though things have gone wrong at the in the NHS since the year dot. And I suspect we might find a similar thing here where, you know, if there are problems with childcare, it will be blamed on this change, even though I'm sure there must be problems with childcare now.
There are problems with childcare now, but that doesn't... What I want to offer is the opposite, is that the changes in the NHS are going to be part of the cause of the problems, and deregulating the childcare industry will be part of the cause of the problems, and we shouldn't skate over that simply because we also know that people will use them politically. They will also be a big cause of problems.
Well, will they, though? I mean, I think what we need is... like proper evidence for this, don't we, to see whether things work. I mean, we could have an entire series of podcasts about the subject of evidence basis for policy making, because I think one of the big problems in this country is that we don't have proper trials of things before they're tried. What happens is a government gets in and they say, this is the right way to do things, this is the new way we're going to do it, and they do it, and sometimes trials are run, but often the evidence from the trials is either ignored or massage to make it look like it's going to work, and then they plough ahead anyway because the changes are ideological. And I think that all governments are guilty of this sort of thing. And when it comes to something like childcare, I know that straight away the argument's going to be, well, we can't take risks with our children, so we couldn't have a trial anyway. But if you're going to introduce new policies, you should at least be pretty sure that they're going to work and or not have deleterious consequences that make it worse than the current situation. I mean, you seem pretty convinced that both the NHS changes and also these changes to childcare definitely will have deleterious effects.
Well, I think there's a reason that we went to a system of regulation in the first place. There's quite a strong history of evidence of what happens when inexperienced, unregistered carers are trying to look after too many children at once. You know, there's quite a body of evidence behind that because it's what happened in the past. Yeah, we know that that causes massive problems. We know that it's children are much more likely to have accidents, much more likely to be unstimulated properly, to be not properly cared for, because they aren't the people who are doing it with all the best will in the world are untrained. They have too many children to look after at once, and this is why each of these regulations were brought in They're not done for fun. We don't regulate things because we think it's funny or because we think everyone should have to adhere to a strict rules because we're authoritarian. It's because there were mistakes that were learned from.
Well, without knowing all the details about what they're proposing, it's probably difficult for me to make any further comment on that. I guess I was just talking about the general principle, but I would certainly like to see more evidence basis in policy making. I mean, I think countries like the US have a better shot at that sort of thing than we do because they have so many different states and the states have quite a lot of autonomy. And so a certain law or rule or set way of doing things will be brought in one state or a couple of states. And then if it works, then other states will take it on and you have control experiments because other states initially haven't made the changes. So maybe if this was happening over there or in another country, maybe it would be taken up in a couple of states. And then if there were big problems with it, then you know, you could call a halt to it and it wouldn't be rolled out across the whole country like is going to happen over here. But, you know, that's the man in Whitehall or the woman in Whitehall says it's going to happen and it ends up happening. And yeah. I mean, that's.
Well, I don't think we have an awful lot of evidence-based policymaking at the moment. And I agree with you that it would be a nice change. But we shouldn't deny the fact that the past is evidence.
No, that's a fair point.
So given that tomorrow Nick and Dave are going to be standing together shoulder to shoulder, exalting the triumphs of the coalition government, how's the differentiation strategy going?
I think Clegg's actually been quite good at that in recent weeks. I mean, the fact that he set out his independent stall on Leveson, the fact that he made a speech or gave an interview talking about drugs, and how, you know, our party would approach it differently if we had our own way. I think that signs that he is trying to set out an independent stall. But of course, every time.
But now he's just doesn't seem to. He seems to have forgotten it over his Christmas dinner.
Well, maybe he's been relaxing too much over Christmas. And of course, they're both going to be doing one of their joint press conference things tomorrow. So, you know, whenever they're both standing next to each other, I always notice that they tend to kind of slip back into agreeing with each other mode. You know, when they're interviewed separately, they tend to then both set out their stall separately. So I don't think tomorrow is going to be a good example of differentiation. But I do think that Clegg got the message. I think he got it after the AV referendum, actually. And he's been slowly moving towards a position where he is.
And he's the world's biggest super tanker because that's a hell of a long turnaround.
Well, I think the AV referendum campaign burned him and the people around him. And I think they realised that what had been happening in the first year, which was you couldn't get a cigarette paper between them, was not going to fly anymore. And I think it took them a while to work out a way through this. And I'm not necessarily saying it's perfect now, but it's better than it was. And I think they're going to have to keep on with this strategy over the coming year and certainly next year as well in the run-up to the 2015 election. So yeah, I'd probably give them, you know, half marks for the way they've done it at the moment. If I was in Clegg's position, I would be setting out my independent stall more often. And for example, when interviewers try and cleverly trip me up by trying to find things that I disagree with, you know, Cameron about or other ministers, I'd just be straight with them and say, yeah, you're right, it's coalition, we don't agree on everything. Still too often Lib Dem ministers try and argue. I mean, I see it with Danny Alexander all the time when he's interviewed. You know, he tries to cleave very closely to the Treasury line. And I don't think he needs to do that. I think he's gone native to an extent and he doesn't need to do that. He should remember that first and foremost he's a Lib Dem. It's in a coalition, and therefore when Jeremy Paxman or whoever is trying to, you know, make mischief by pointing out where places where the Lib Dems might not agree with the Conservatives, you should just be honest and say, yeah, we don't agree with that. And if we were in government on our own, we wouldn't have done that. We're in a coalition. And I think if Lib Dems just started saying that, okay, at first, you know, someone like Paxman would say, are you really saying that you are doing things that you don't want to do? You know, are you a man or a mouse, Mr. Alexander? Yeah, I could just imagine the sort of nonsense that will come out. Yeah. But pretty quickly, that'll all die away because I think most people in this country do recognise that that's the reality. And I don't think ministers, Lib Dem ministers or Tory ministers, need to pretend that that isn't the case. I think they should.
Yeah, and I think there is a certain amount of the kind of political doublespeak that the coalition are just as good as everyone else. They won't tell the truth if they can get away with telling something that sounds truthful but better.
Yeah, I know.
There was a very good Damien McBride, ironically, piece about this in, I think, it was the papers today or yesterday.
It was Independent. Yeah, I think I read it. I read it about an hour ago. Yeah.
There you go. And that the public just don't buy that stuff anymore. The question you should be asking me is nonsense. And I think that the certain members of the coalition, and I think Dali Alexander is a really good example of that. He really just tries way too hard to sound like a government minister rather than trying to sound like a senior Lib Dem. I don't think the differentiation strategy is going very well, to be honest with you, as an outsider. I think that you flirt with it and then you run away from it, and you flirt with it and then you run away from it. And when it comes down to the actual detail of legislation and stuff that you should be digging your heels in about, there's very little to prove that differentiation is happening.
I think one of the problems, though, Emma, is that a lot of the heel digging goes on behind closed doors. And what you end up with is the policy is a fait accompli that's been negotiated behind closed doors. And I think actually what would be better, and I think that Lib Dem ministers are getting this message, that more of the argument has to happen in public than in private. And that has its risks, because it starts to look like the government is divided and ill-disciplined and all the rest of it. But it's got to happen. Because otherwise, in the run-up to the next election, people aren't going to understand what difference the Lib Dems have made.
Well, yeah, but he also has to be successful. I mean, this is exactly the point I was coming to, which is that there was loads of floating of, we're going to get a mansion tax, we will not let George Osborne cut welfare unless there's also a tax on the rich. And when it came down to the autumn statement, there was a cut on welfare and no attack on the rich.
Yeah, I was disappointed with that. And actually, I feel that... that something that Nick Clegg said at Lib Dem conference hasn't been adhered to. Well, at least not in the way that I anticipated, given what he said, because he had a Q&A session in the main hall that I attended, and he was asked about the next budget, or, you know, the next pre-budget statement, and, you know, what was going to happen about welfare and, you know, cuts, and who were the cuts going to affect. And he said that, if there are going to be any more cuts to the welfare budget, then we need to start at the top and work our way down. And I don't think that really happened.
No.
I mean, I think they can probably argue that it did. They can probably point to some technicalities about how this was approached and claim that they've stuck to that. But I don't personally think that that washes. I think the fact that they've frozen most working age benefits at 1% for 3 years is a cut to the lower end of welfare recipients. So I don't think they've stuck to that. And I'm not happy that they didn't get the mansion tax. What we seem to have got is a further movement on the income tax threshold. And I find that whole thing quite interesting, because that was clearly Lib Dem policy. It wasn't a Conservative policy. And the number of Conservative ministers that I have heard talking up that policy, it's really starting to piss me off now, because I'm sure some people listening to the radio and watching the television will just think that must have been a Conservative policy. It wasn't.
Well, it's not hard to think, you know, cutting tax, Conservative policy. And that is where you're going to have some problems, because those areas, and that's what people tell me is the flagship Lib Dem policy, the taking people out of income, lower paid people out of income tax. I think you've got two problems. One, I don't think people feel it because of all the other things that are hitting them, like the freezing wages, like the raising VAT. The council tax benefit issue is going to be enormous this year. That is going to be a real problem for people. So I think partly the problem you've got is if it were in isolation a thing, people would be like, oh, that's quite good. I think in terms of the overall feeling that people have, I don't think it makes them feel better enough to counteract all this stuff that's being raked back from them. And the other thing you've got is it doesn't differentiate you enough, because it doesn't feel Lib Dem-y in a way that is separate from Conservative-y.
I mean, I think that's probably a fair point. And I know that there were a lot of certainly Conservative activists and bloggers people like Tim Montgomery and I think Ian Dale before the 2010 election were actually saying that the Lib Dem policy of getting the threshold up to 10,000 is a great policy. Why haven't the Conservatives proposed it? So I think it was quite popular with Conservatives. And I'm sure it's one of those policies that during the coalition negotiations, it was, yeah, no problem, we'll have that, slam dunk, no questions asked. You know, I don't think that was a controversial measure because I think, like you say, it goes with the grain of what Conservatives would like to do anyway. And, you know, we're seeing the evidence now that they're going around trying to take credit for it. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a difficult situation. I don't think that the Lib Dems have got as much in recent times out of the government as they'd have liked. But again, I come back to the fact that we've got 57 MPs and the Tories have got 300 MPs. I mean, you can't...
You've got the balance of power. You don't play that nearly hard enough.
But the political reality is that the Lib Dems are, you know, at whatever it is, 12, 13, 15%, and in some polls a lot less than that. And, you know, if the Lib Dems were at 22, 23, 24% in the polls, we would have a lot of leverage. You'd be able to say, well, you know, this is what we want. If you're not going to give it us, we'll walk away. Because we'd be quite happy that, you know, come if there was an election, then we'd be fine. We won't be fine. If the government was to fall apart right now, I think the Lib Dems would be absolutely slaughtered. And, you know, I think Labour would get in with a majority of 100 or more. And that's the political reality. And it's been, I mean, credit to the Labour Party for what they did in the first year. I'm using the word credit slightly sarcastically, but credit to them for having attacked the Lib Dems and attacked the Lib Dems and accused them of selling out and, you know, abandoning their principles and all the rest of it. And people took note of that. And the Lib Dems have suffered in the polls for that. So you say we've got the balance of power, but that implies that, you know, we are able to just make our demands. And, you know, if you're not going to go along with it, you know.
Saying that being in government and doing anything in government is the price that you pay for not being annihilated, and you have to go along with anything that comes along, whatever it be, say the death penalty, killing of the firstborn, but it'll keep you in power another 2 years.
None of those policies have been implemented.
Yet.
I mean, what I'm saying, I'm trying to just, you know, you were saying earlier on about people being honest. No Lib Dem minister is ever going to say what I've just said. But that is the reality. That is the truth. That we don't have the kind of leverage that we would have if our poll ratings were double what they are now. If the poll ratings were double what they are now, we'd be getting more Lib Dem policies in this government. I'm absolutely certain of it. You've got to take account of the political reality. We can't walk away from this government. We can't threaten to walk away from it because it's not a credible threat. So
you can threaten to vote down individual measures far more often than you do. You don't have to pass each piece of legislation. I'm not saying you should threaten every piece of legislation. I think you should be very, very careful and pick and choose very, very carefully.
No.
But I think there are measures on which you could have said, no, not that one. We cannot do that one. I think you had the opportunity to do it on the NHS.
And I come back to my earlier point.
Laws reform, which then didn't happen.
Well, I come back to my earlier point that is happening behind the scenes. You obviously don't think that the kind of concessions that the Lib Dems have got are good enough. But concessions have been made, and the policies that this government has implemented have been quite different from the policies that a purely Conservative government would have implemented.
That's what I think.
We'll have to wait until the memoirs before we know all the details about what happened behind closed doors. But that is definitely happening at the moment. But, you know, at the end of the day, if the Lib Dems started doing what you've just suggested, and, you know, every few weeks there was a new bit of legislation that the Lib Dems then said, okay, well, we're not going to let this one through, and they were quite public about it and they voted against it, we would very rapidly move to a position where the Lib Dems' position in government is untenable, and they would actually have to move to a confidence and supply situation. And I think were that to happen, that would then precipitate a general election in a few months, maybe 6 months. So I think that either the Lib Dems are in government and they fight for what they can behind closed doors, and I would argue they should do so more publicly. And then they stand behind what they've, you know, what the government's done. And we'll see what the electorate says in 2015. But the idea that they can just force the government's hand all the time and keep saying, well, it's got to be this and it's got to be that, it's just not realistic given the political situation.
Here's the thing. We're talking about you making Tory policy better or worse. That's kind of what we're talking about now.
Great.
You know, all the stuff we've talked about in the last 5 minutes has been, can you make this Tory policy a bit better? Can you stop the Tories doing this, that, or the other? I think in 50 years' time, when the historians come back to look at this government, there will be no big Lib Dem thing that will have come out of this government. That we won't have changed the voting system. We won't have Lords reform. You know, you'll have tinkered around the edges of the tax system, and that's it. And that's what people are telling me is your big win from this government.
Well, funnily enough, when I asked Nick Clegg pretty much that question at conference, his initial, because I was going to be quite interested in what he was going to say, because I sort of agree with what you said. I think that in decades to come, we will look back and it will be difficult to see what the Lib Dem specific imprint on this government was. His response to that question was, we've been in coalition. We will have been in coalition. You know, it's the first one for 60 years. Almost the fact that the Lib Dems were in government in and of itself, he considered to be a very major thing. And that's probably what the historians are going to write about the most. He's probably right about that.
Oh, well, if that pleases you, then...
I didn't necessarily say it pleases me, Emma. I just said I think he's probably right about that.
I think that if that's your win, the fact that the electoral math made it basically the only option for you to go into government with the Conservatives, and that's the big thing that you've managed to get out of this five-year government, okay, well done. It certainly has changed the way people look at the Lib Dems. That is true.
I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. I mean, you know, I've agreed to a certain extent with some of the stuff you said here. I don't think this government has been a complete disaster. You obviously have very strong feelings that things like the NHS bill, the tuition fees and various other things that have gone through have been a complete disaster. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think things like the way, you know, the tuition fees, I mean, politically, it was a disaster for the Lib Dems. But I think that they did make quite substantial differences to that policy in the way that it's been implemented, in the way it is fairer than what was in place before, for example. And I'm not convinced that if the Conservatives had been in government on their own, that they'd have been able to, you know, that they would have done that.
I think the management of the economy by this government has been a disaster. I don't think anyone could argue otherwise without basing that not on facts, not on evidence.
I actually don't agree with that either. I don't necessarily think this has been a disaster. I think it's been very, very difficult, but I don't agree that the alternative that Labour was proposing would have been any better. We can't run a counterfactual, so we can't know. We can't know if Labour had got in and not taken the measures that this government did with the cuts and everything, and probably as importantly, the rhetoric around the cuts to reassure the markets, whether the markets would have just caused massive, massive problems in this country. We can't know. So when you say that, you know, unless you ignore the evidence, then you can't say it's not a disaster. I don't think what are you comparing it with?
Would happen were we won't lose our AAA rating. We won't go back into recession. As we cut back the public sector, the private sector will rush in. It will free up that space for the private sector to rush in and rebalance and rebuild our economy. Where's the beef? We're going to lose our AAA. We've had a double dip. We may be heading for a triple dip. And the private sector has not rushed in. In fact, they've held their sense of, well, we don't think now's the right time to spend on anything.
Yeah, but again, I just come back to the same point that, okay, so things haven't panned out the way that the government wanted, and that's for sure. But there's no guarantee that the alternative scenario would have been any better. It could have been worse. We'll never know. But I think what the governor of the Bank of England said just before the 2010 election was very right, that whoever gets in, it's going to be very, very difficult. And I mean, I hope that the second part of what he said doesn't come true. But he basically said that they wouldn't be in power again for a generation, whoever formed the next government after 2010. I hope he's wrong about that. But in terms of it being very, very difficult, he is absolutely right. So
it was never going to be easy, but we didn't have to put George Osborne at the helm. Well, and it's very, very ideologically based measures that have simply not come to fruition.
Yeah, if it had been my choice, I'd have put Vince Cable as Chancellor. But, you know, I don't think that was ever going to wash with, you know, quite a lot of the Tory party. So Osborne it had to be, unfortunately.
On that grim note for 2013, Osborne it has to be. I think we should probably call it to an end, because we are well over time once again, I'd just like to thank Audioboo for hosting, and also Kevin MacLeod at incomtech.com for our funky intro and outro music. And thank you very much, Mark, for once again a fascinating discussion.
Thank you very much, Emma. Good to speak to you.
Cheers.